Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. In this audio, I'm going to cover a very difficult chapter, Isaiah chapter 7, which I will call The Virgin Shall Conceive. I call it that because it contains the famous virgin prophecy in Isaiah 7:14, which Matthew said applied to the Virgin Mary, and which, of course, has occasioned mountains and mountains of theological publications. This chapter will involve a lot of dates, a lot of kings, some battles, some place names within Jerusalem, all of which will make it challenging, so I'll try to take us through it and at the same time keep my sanity and yours also. We start with verses 1 through 6 of Isaiah chapter 7. When Ahaz is the southern king. He ruled from 732/31 to 716/15. He was the son of Jotham, who ruled from 740 to 732, and Jotham was the son of Uzziah, who ruled from 767 to 740. Well, the only dates we need to remember here is Ahaz. He started his reign in 732 or 731. These are Thiele's dates. He was king of Judah and then king Rezin of Aram. Aram is Syria. And Pekah ruled from 740/739 to 732/731. So we are now at the end of Pekah's reign and the beginning of Ahaz's reign. So Pekah was the son of Remaliah. He was king of Israel. That's northern Israel, the northern 10 tribes. So Pekah of northern Israel and Rezin of Syria marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower it. Now the house of David was told, Aram has allied itself with Ephraim. Ephraim is the name of the northern 10 tribes of Israel. That's because Ephraim was their major tribe. Aram, Syria, has allied itself with Ephraim. So the hearts of Ahaz, the southern king, and his people were shaken, as the trees of the forest are shaken by the wind. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, Go out, you and your son Shear-Jashub. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, Go out, you and your son Shear-Jashub, to meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to Washerman's Field. Say to him, Be careful, keep calm, and don't be afraid. Do not lose heart because of those two smoldering stubs of firewood, because of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram, and of the son of Remaliah. The two smoldering stubs, of course, were the two kings in alliance against Ahaz, Pekah of northern Israel and Rezin of Syria. Those two smoldering stubs of firewood. Aram, Syria, Ephraim, northern Israel, and Remaliah's son, that's Pekah, have plotted against your ruin. Aram, that's Syria, Ephraim, that's northern Israel, and Remaliah's son, that's Pekah, have plotted your ruin, saying, Let us invade Judah, let us tear it apart and divide it among ourselves, and make the son of Tabeel king over it. All right, we're going to have to do some introduction of this chapter. First of all, this prophecy, how long was it? Well, all the way from Isaiah 7:1 to Isaiah 9:7 is a single prophecy. We are just going to take up Isaiah 7 today. Now, there's much disagreement regarding the interpretation, as Albert Barnes says, and I'm sure you probably know already. As Barnes says, probably no portion of the Bible has been regarded as so difficult of interpretation and has given rise to so great a variety of expositions as the prophecy which is commenced in this chapter and which is closed in Isaiah 9:7. The importance of the prophecy respecting the Messiah, that's Isaiah 7:14 and following, also Isaiah 8:7 and Isaiah 9:1-7, that's Emmanuel, is one reason why interpreters have been so anxious to ascertain the genuine sense, and the difficulties attending the supposition that there is a reference to the Messiah have been among the causes why so much anxiety has been felt to ascertain its true sense. These are messianic prophecies, and so that's important, of course, to Christians, and so that's why all the attention to these three chapters. Now, I'm going to give you a rough historical timeline here. It's very important to keep just a few dates in mind so we don't get overwhelmed by all the dates involved, but they are key. First of all, in 740, Pekah, the king of northern Israel, he began his reign. He ended his reign in 732. Now, in that year, 732, Ahaz began his reign. And in that year, Pekah allied himself with Rezin of Syria, and sometime around that time, they invade Judah. So let's keep that in mind. Northern Israel and Syria are united against Judah, and in fact have invaded Judah. In the same year, 732 B.C., Tiglath-Pileser III of Assyria captures Rezin in Damascus and kills him, and then also defeated Pekah of northern Israel. And so Ahaz is relieved of the two nations that are threatening to kill him. 10 years later, in 722 BC, Shalmaneser V of Assyria, and when he dies, Sargon II takes over, and they defeat northern Israel and take the northern Israelites into exile. In 669, another Assyrian king, Esarhaddon, dies after finishing the depopulation of northern Israel. He carried off what little Israelites remained. And 667 is the end of Isaiah's 65 years that he prophesied in verse 8, which we'll get to. Isaiah prophesied to Ahaz, by the end of 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered. And I'm going to take that shattering of Ephraim to be connected with Esarhaddon's carrying off the remains of the northern Israelites. Now, I've got Esarhaddon died in 669. That's a firm date. 667 is a little bit past Esarhaddon's death. But once you get within 2 years dealing with this ancient chronology, that's close enough. So 732 is a key date. And 732 BC, Pekah ended his reign of northern Israel. Ahaz, the southern kingdom of Judah, began his reign. And then Pekah of northern Israel, allied with Rezin of Syria, invaded Judah. And then those two enemies were whacked out by the Assyrian king, Tiglath-Pileser III, in that same year, 732. So 732 is where we are now. This is when Isaiah is going to come prophesy to Ahaz. It's a key year. Now let's take some more historical background information from Albert Barnes. He says, when Ahaz came to the throne, that's 732 approximately, the alliance between Pekah and Rezin was continued from the time it was made in Jotham's time. In other words, Pekah and Rezin had actually got together before Ahaz took the throne. They got together in the previous reign of Jotham, but the actual execution of the alliance took place after Ahaz got on the throne at 732. So the effort was renewed to take Jerusalem, Barnes continues. Formidable preparations were made for the war, and an invading army came up upon the land. That's the land of Judah, the southern kingdom, invading army of Pekah and Rezin. Many of the subjects of Ahaz were taken captive and carried to Damascus, the capital of Syria. Pekah killed in one day 120,000 people, so the people of Judah lost 120,000 people. Ahaz had to face that. Pekah took 200,000 captives, carried them towards Samaria. That's the capital of northern Israel, just north of Jerusalem and Ephraim. And so Ahaz had to face that. He lost 200,000 captives. 120,000 killed, 200,000 taken captive. Ahaz is in deep doo-doo. Now, these captives were released from bondage by the solicitation of Oded, a prophet, who represented to them the impropriety of taking their brethren captive, and they, the prisoners, were reconveyed to Jericho. At about the same time, the Assyrians took Eilat, the great port city at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, and retained it as a city belonging to them. I assume Judah had Eilat, and Ahaz lost Eilat. So he's lost people killed, he's lost people taken captive, and now he's lost his great port. From the report of this strong alliance and from the ravages which were committed by their united forces, Ahaz was alarmed and trembled for the safety of Jerusalem itself. And in his distress, Ahaz looked to Assyria rather than God. And that's the purpose of Isaiah's prophecy here, is look, Ahaz, don't mess with Assyria. You don't need to. If you'll just rely on God, God will take care of this. Ahaz doesn't listen. He allies himself with Assyria. And Assyria, in response to Ahaz's request, assaults Damascus, Rezin's capital of Syria. Now, Syria wanted to do that anyway, I'm sure, but they did it on behalf of Ahaz in 2 Kings 16:9. So the king of Assyria listened to him, listened to Ahaz, and marched up to Damascus and captured it. He deported his people to Kir, but put Rezin to death. Okay, so Rezin is gone. Hot diggity dog for Ahaz. Unfortunately for Ahaz, Assyria was more interesting in capturing Judah than in helping Pekah. And that is foretold in our chapter 7, verses 17 through 25, which we'll get to in a minute. And in the next chapter, Isaiah 8, 7 through 8. So Ahaz allies himself with Assyria, and his alliance gave him some short-term gain, but some long-term pain. And Isaiah is trying to stop him. So that's our background. Now, Ahaz had done a lot of bad stuff before the invasion of Pekah and Rezin. Albert Barnes gives some examples. Ahaz erected altars and groves of idolatry everywhere. He sacrificed to the Baalim, to the Baals. He burned his children in the valley of Hinnom in honor of Moloch, and he polluted Jerusalem with idolatry. So that's what happens when you are an idol-worshipping king and you claim to worship the God of the universe, Yahweh, you get invaded. Now, I mentioned earlier in my introduction that this confederacy between Pekah of northern Israel and Rezin of Syria was actually formed earlier than 732 when Ahaz took control of Judah. The previous king before Ahaz was Jotham. We read that in 2 Kings 15:36 through 37. The rest of the events of Jotham's reign, along with all his accomplishments, they are written in the historical record of Judah's kings. In those days, the Lord began sending Rezin, king of Aram, and Pekah, son of Remaliah, against Judah. So it all started in Jotham's time, and the culmination was right here at the critical time at the beginning of Ahaz's reign in 732. Now, verse 1 tells us that Pekah and Rezin marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower Jerusalem. Now, Barnes speculates that this unsuccessful invasion of Jerusalem may have been in the times of Jotham. Another option, which Barnes thinks is less likely, is that this statement is a general statement that after all the efforts of Pekah and Rezin, Jerusalem was not taken. Well, whether it was Pekah and Rezin trying to get Jerusalem during Jotham's time or Ahaz's time, it doesn't really matter. Jerusalem was not conquered. But nonetheless, they were in a world of trouble. Verse 2, now the house of David was told, that's the southern kingdom of Judah, Ahaz, the people in Ahaz's administration, they were told Aram, that's Syria, has allied itself with Ephraim, that's northern Israel. Aram is Rezin, northern Israel. Ephraim is Pekah. Aram has allied itself with Ephraim, so the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken as the trees of the forest are shaken by the wind. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out, you and your son Shear-Jashub, to meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool. So Isaiah goes and has his famous meeting with Ahaz. He takes his son Shear-Jashub with him. Now Shear-Jashub means a remnant shall return. The Hebrew is just transliterated into English. A remnant shall return. Now, here are a couple of options as to what that means. Option number one, Shear-Jashub, a remnant shall return, is a sign that Judah would not be utterly destroyed by Pekah or Rezin. Albert Barnes believes that's the correct option. Barnes says that Judah could not be permanently subject to Syria or Samaria. And as a matter of fact, that never happened to Judah. In other words, Judah has managed to survive even after all those POWs and killed people. 120,000 killed, 200,000 taken captive. But there's a remnant because Judah didn't go down. I think that's reasonable. Another option is that a remnant shall return is a sign that Judah would not be permanently subject to Assyria. Even if Judah was captured and carried captive by the Assyrians, Judah would still live on with its remnant. Well, whatever it meant, it was meant by Isaiah to give confidence to Ahaz. Look, Judah is not going down. There's always going to be a remnant. You will not be permanently subject either to Pekah or Rezin, northern Israel or Syria, or by Assyria. And of course, Assyria, a little bit further to the east in the Mesopotamian Valley, present-day Iraq, they were the big boys in the ancient Near East. Pekah and Rezin were small fry, and Israel was even smaller fry. Now, the next question is why did Isaiah go down to the Kidron Valley to the east of the city of David in Jerusalem to meet Ahaz? Why was Ahaz outside of town? Why was he out of town? Some options suggested he could have been at his country house. He hears the designs of the enemies. He heads back to Jerusalem where it was safer, and he hadn't gotten all the way back yet. It could be that Ahaz was outside of the city reconnoitering the passes, looking to see who's coming to attack him. But for whatever reason, he's out there. Now in verse 3, the Lord says to Isaiah, meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool. Other translations have conduit of the upper pool. Now let's talk about this upper pool. This is a famous place. It's been identified by most of the archaeologists and scholars who look at this sort of thing. For example, biblicalarchaeologytruth.com says that the upper pool is the ancient rock-cut pool located near the Gihon Spring. That's G-I-H-O-N. I hope I pronounced it right. The Gihon Spring was halfway up the eastern slope of the city of David. The city of David, of course, is that promontory slice of land that juts out from Mount Moriah to the north down to the valley of Hinnom in the south. bounded by the Tyrrhenian Valley on the west and the Kidron Valley on the east, about halfway from north to south and halfway up from bottom to top is roughly where this Gihon Spring was. Now, later Hezekiah made a famous tunnel that ran from the Gihon Spring through the wall of Jerusalem down into the Pool of Siloam at the southern tip of the city of David. We'll talk about that when we get there. Great tourist spot. Unfortunately, my tour guide didn't take us there when I was in Israel. Now, another geographical location mentioned here in verse 3 is the Washerman's Field. KJV has the Fuller's Field. A fuller is one who whitens cloth. To full something is to press or to scour cloth in a mill. And so that field somewhere near the upper pool was there to get water for washing to carry out the fulling process. The location of the Washerman's Field is not known for sure. BibleAtlas.org has it in the Valley of Hinnom down to the south, as that was the direction which the water flowed from the upper pool of Gihon. So Isaiah is out here, and he says to Ahaz in verse 4, don't lose heart because of these two smoldering stubs. He's referring to Pekah of northern Israel and Rezin of Syria. Two smoldering stubs of firewood. That's a great metaphor. A stub of firewood is not strong enough to burn. It's weak. It's about to go out. So Isaiah is trying to buck up the frightened King Ahaz of Judah, southern Israel. Isaiah announces in verse 5 that Pekah and Rezin have plotted Ahaz's ruin, saying, let's invade Judah. And I think that Ahaz probably already knew that. I don't think that was a prophecy, really. He was just repeating the obvious. Let us invade Judah. Let us tear it apart and divide it. And then Pekah and Rezin are going to make the son of Tabeel king over it. Now, who is this son of Tabeel? Here's some speculations. Jameson Fawcett Brown says, we don't know, so who cares? Option number 1 is the name of some great prince, either of Israel or of Syria, otherwise unknown to us. The great scholar Lightfoot says it's Tabrimon, the name of some famous family in Syria. Who knows? It means the goodness of God. There's an interesting note here. Actually, Tabeel doesn't mean the goodness of God. Tabeel, T-A-B-A-L, means the goodness of God. If you take the A and switch it to E, the vocalization Tabeel instead of Tabeel is a deliberately derogatory alteration. It now, Tabeel means no good or good for nothing. So Isaiah might have been taunting the enemies of Israel at this point. We move now to Isaiah 7, verses 7 through 9. Isaiah continues, yet this is what the sovereign Lord says. And now we're quoting God now. Isaiah is, it will not take place. It will not happen. For the head of Aram is Damascus. What won't take place? The dividing of Judah up by Pekah and Rezin, not going to happen. It will not happen, for the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is only Rezin. Within 65 years, Ephraim will be too shattered to be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is only Remaliah's son. Remaliah, of course, is the father of Pekah. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. Now, when Isaiah announces his prophecy of what Yahweh is saying, he says, this is what the sovereign Yahweh says, indicating that God could easily take care of Pekah and Rezin because God is sovereign, Pekah and Rezin are not. In verse 8, Isaiah says, the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is only Rezin. Now, this is a strange statement. What it means is that we've got the land of Syria up there, and it's got a capital, Damascus, and it's got a king, Rezin. That's it. That's the only country that Rezin would govern. His dominion should not be enlarged. So don't worry, Ahaz. Rezin is going to stay within his bounds. Now, in the NIV, we have the word only Rezin, for the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is only Rezin, which gives the idea that he's just one guy. His kingdom is not going to expand. But I must point out that almost all of the other translations I looked at leave out the only. So that is a translator's interpretation here. NIV is a relatively loose translation, but I think it's reasonable. As Benson, Joseph Benson, the commentator, says, as Damascus is the head city of Syria, and Rezin is the head or king of Damascus, so shall they continue to be, and not advance themselves, and enlarge their territories by possessing themselves of Jerusalem and the kingdom of Judah as they design. Rezin shall be kept within his own bounds and be head of Damascus only. Well, after delivering that comforting thought, Isaiah continues in verse 8, within 65 years, Ephraim will be too shattered to be a people. Now, there's been lots of learned theological ink spilt over this 65-year period. The best option, according to John Gill, Adam Clark, and Jameson Fawcett and Brown, is that the beginning of the 65 years is at the time this prophecy was delivered, which is at the beginning of the reign of Ahaz, which is roughly 732 B.C., that key date I told you. Now, Thiele gives Ahaz's dates as 732/731 to 716/715. Again, there's always controversy over exactly when a reign starts and ends. You got the reign date. Do you use the accession date, or do you use the next year after the accession and all that? And I can't get into that. That's for real pinheaded nerds who get into this sort of stuff. So, understanding that there's a little bit of fuzziness and imprecision about these dates, let's calculate this 65-year period. Well, if Ahaz is ruling in 732, that's when Isaiah came to see him at the upper pool near the washerman's field. 65 years from then, when Ephraim would be shattered within that 65-year period, if you take 65 years from 732, you end up in 667. Well, we know that Esarhaddon of Assyria came in and cleaned up northern Israel of Israelites and carried them into exile. Esarhaddon died in 669, which is 63 years later after the prophecy, not 65, but it's within 2 years, and as I say, you get within 2 years of the ancient dates, that's close enough. Now, the 669 death of Esarhaddon is a firm date. I confirmed it with Wikipedia, Britannica, and worldhistory.org. Now, remember, northern Israel had gotten wiped out after the times of Pekah in 722. Hoshea was king, I think, at the time in northern Israel, and the two Assyrian kings that destroyed Samaria, the northern kingdom, Shalmaneser V and Sargon II, they did that in 722. Shalmaneser V died in the middle of the siege. So that was a big deportation. However, we read in many passages in 2 Chronicles and 2 Kings that there were Israelites still left over in the land despite that initial deportation by Sargon II. Well, Esarhaddon came and finished the job near the end of his life within Isaiah 65 years. And notice Isaiah said within 65 years. He didn't say at the end of 65 years. So even if the dates are a little bit off, it doesn't matter. Somewhere in that time, Esarhaddon came and cleaned up northern Israel. So he was correct in his prophecies, and that prophecy was meant to give Ahaz some encouragement. Now we go to verse 9. God is speaking, quoted by Isaiah. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is only Remaliah's son. Remaliah's son is Pekah. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. Again, verse 9 is to encourage Ahaz to not ally himself with Assyria. The idea is the head of Ephraim is Samaria. Samaria is the capital city of the northern 10 tribes of Israel. Ephraim is the name that was used to call the northern kingdom. So Samaria is the capital, the head of it. And the head of Samaria is Pekah, and that's all it's going to be. Same idea as in verse 8 when we were talking about, the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. That's the way it's going to be. It's not going to change from that. Rezin is not going to enlarge his territory. Likewise, Pekah is not going to enlarge his territory. He's going to be stuck right there in Samaria. He's not going to capture Judah. So God tells Ahaz, you better stand firm in your faith and believe, because if you don't, you will not stand. Well, of course, Ahaz, he's not going to listen to God. He's going to ally himself with Assyria. We go now to Isaiah 7, verses 10 through 13. Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz. So we have another quotation from Yahweh to Ahaz. Ask the Lord your God for a sign, whether in the deepest depths or in the highest heights. But Ahaz said, I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test. Oh, how holy Ahaz sounds here. Then Isaiah said, hear now, you house of David, is it not enough to try the patience of men? Will you try the patience of my God also? Now in verse 11, Yahweh says to Ahaz, ask the Lord your God. He calls himself the God of Ahaz, despite the fact that Ahaz was a very wicked man, yet Yahweh was still his God. He knows that Ahaz disbelieves in him, but he asked Ahaz to ask for a sign. In other words, Ahaz, I want you to show your faith in me. Show where your true colors are. Ahaz did show his true colors. In verse 12, he says, I will not ask, But now he covers up his lack of faith in God with a sanctimonious veneer. I'm not going to put you to the test. Well, how is it putting God to the test? God asked him to ask for a sign. Now, if you ask for a sign, do I need to get out of bed this morning? I'm kind of lazy. God, please make a meteor fall out of the sky and land in my backyard. Well, yeah, that's putting God to the test. But not if God says, Dan, I want you to ask for me a sign. I want you to ask for me to put a meteor in the backyard. Well, that's not testing the Lord. That's doing what he asked. And so Ahaz is exposed here as a total hypocrite. And Isaiah got upset. In verse 13, he says, Hear now, you house of David. Now he's not just talking to Ahaz. He's talking to Ahaz and all of his descendants and all of his officials. Well, he actually wasn't talking to his descendants. His descendants weren't there yet, unless they were children who had not taken the throne yet. I don't know. I can't remember. But Ahaz is now being spoken to as a dynast, as the head of a dynasty. But I think mostly Isaiah is talking to all of his counselors, and he's saying, Look, you've tried the patience of men, that would be Isaiah, but now you're going to try the patience of my God also. Isaiah calls God my God. You're really trying him. So Isaiah saw straight through Ahaz's hypocrisy. And now we go to the famous prophecy, Isaiah 7:14-16. Isaiah says to Ahaz, Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. You won't ask for a sign, well, God's going to do it on his own motion. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and will call him Emmanuel. He will eat curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. But before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste, the two kings being, of course, Pekah of northern Israel and Rezin of Samaria. Now, there's been about as many books written on this as the number of books written on what does the filioque clause mean in medieval Christian history. I'm going to do my best with it. We'll try to simplify it a little bit. First of all, the word virgin. The virgin will be with child. There is a translation problem here because the Hebrew word alma could either be translated virgin or young maiden. Conservatives split on this. For example, the NET Bible, the NET Bible, say young maiden. Says young maiden, the NIV and the KJV say virgin. The issue is incredibly complicated, but fortunately, the understanding of this passage does not matter whether the word means virgin or whether it means young maiden. After all, most young maidens back then were virgins, but even if they're not, it doesn't matter, as you'll see. And the reason it doesn't matter is because Matthew, in his chapter 1, he clearly referred to this prophecy, and he says that Jesus would be born of a virgin. He quotes the prophecy, but he also states in another verse that Mary was a virgin. So he's not depending on this word virgin meaning virgin. Not here, anyway. Now, Glenn Miller of the Christian Think Tank alerted me to that the translation of the word doesn't really matter, which is very helpful because that cuts out a lot of scholarly controversy. Now, let's look at the two basic conservative views of this prophecy. Who's the virgin? Well, the first conservative view is the single fulfillment view. And that view states that Isaiah here is directly prophesying about Jesus. He's not talking about any event during Ahaz's time. Now, this single fulfillment view was held by the early church all the way up until the mid-18th century. Some of the luminaries of that period that believed the single fulfillment view would be John Calvin, John Gill. There are also modern authors who hold this view, including Edward J. Young, the prestigious Old Testament scholar. I have a lot of trouble with that view. Fortunately, there is a double fulfillment view, the other conservative view, which states that Isaiah prophesied about a pregnant young woman in Ahaz and Isaiah's time, and that birth was a type of Jesus' virgin birth. Now, there are two versions of this double fulfillment view. Some of those who hold this view say that Isaiah did not know he was prophesying about Jesus in the future, and some say that Isaiah did know he was prophesying about Jesus in the future. I tend to think that he did not know about which he was prophesying in the future. I think of that verse that Peter wrote that the Old Testament prophets searched and searched and searched trying to figure out what was being prophesied about. At any rate, the double fulfillment view is the predominant conservative view now, including the late, great Gleason Archer, and that view, I think, makes a lot more sense. The reason I don't like the single fulfillment view is why in the world would Isaiah go to Ahaz and give him a prophecy that had absolutely nothing to do with him? Makes no sense. Well, having poisoned the well, let me give you some arguments for the single fulfillment view. First of all, Isaiah says, the virgin shall be with child. Well, if you hold to the double fulfillment view, there has to be a virgin in Ahaz's time who would be pregnant. Of course, the pregnancy would come after she got married. So you have to find somebody who's a virgin at the time of the prophecy and then gets married and has a child. The double fulfillment view has trouble naming a particular individual who fit the bill. Also, in favor of the single fulfillment view, is that this son is going to be called Emmanuel, which is a special name, not just an ordinary name given to a child. So the argument goes, sounds like the Messiah. Isaiah 8, 7, and 8, therefore the Lord is about to bring against them the mighty floodwaters of the river, the Euphrates River, the king of Assyria with all his pomp. It will overflow all its channels, run over all its banks, and sweep on into Judah, swirling over it, passing through it, and reaching up to the neck. Its outspread wings will cover the breadth of your land. O Emmanuel, God is with us. I don't think that's a dispositive argument. A young woman in the time of Ahaz could name her son Emmanuel, God is with us. What's so shocking about that? I mean, we just looked at a name, a remnant shall return, Shir Jashub. They like to give their children spiritual sounding names. All right, well, let's look at another argument for the single fulfillment view. How could an ordinary birth of a boy be assigned to Ahaz? What's the big deal? Young lady has a baby? So what? How is that a sign? Now, a virgin birth is definitely a sign in the New Testament, but it's not going to be a sign in the Old Testament, so the single fulfillment view says Isaiah is only talking about the New Testament. Well, the double fulfillment people answer and say, well, it wasn't a virgin birth that was the sign. It was the name Emmanuel that was given to the baby. And when Ahaz finds out that some noble woman in his court has given birth to a child named Emmanuel, the light bulb would go on, he would know, hey, this is the fulfillment of the prophecy. Now, other suggestions have been given besides that, besides the name of Emmanuel being the sign. Some people say, well, this woman was barren. She couldn't conceive it. Oh, my goodness, she's pregnant. Well, that's not really a sign. Lots of women who were thought to be barren have had kids. Some people suggested the sign was is that Isaiah predicted a male child and the child was male. Well, that's a 50% chance on that. That's not it. Another people suggest that the sign given to Ahaz, if it was a prophecy that referred to Ahaz's time, was the child ate curds and honey. Problem with that is, what's the big deal about that? It was natural for young children to eat curds and honey. Some people say it's the whole totality of circumstances around this birth. First the name, Emmanuel, the fact that he's eating curds and honey, and then we say, oh, look, Pekah and Rezin got killed, and so then with the advantage of hindsight, Ahaz can look and say, oh, that was the sign. I don't like any of that. I think that the sign was the fact that the young maiden got married, she had a baby, and she named it Emmanuel. She didn't know about the prophecy that Isaiah had given to Ahaz because it was done privately. Ahaz hears about the birth of this child, finds out the name is Emmanuel, and he says that's the sign that Isaiah predicted. Now, here is a point in favor of the single fulfillment view, the view that I don't hold, that most conservatives don't hold today. It's a point in defense. The single fulfillment view, as I said, has a problem. How can a sign that's going to be fulfilled 700 plus years in the future, how could it be assigned to Ahaz? Why would he even care? He'd be dead. Well, the answer to that, from the single fulfillment point of view, is that the prophecy is not directed to Ahaz. In verse 13, the prophecy is directed to the house of David, and that would include Ahaz's descendants, and Isaiah's prophecy would be written down, and therefore the sign would be available to Ahaz's descendants. And the sign would be that the house of David is not going to go down, and in fact the house of David was resurrected by Jesus after it did go down in 586 when the Babylonians wiped out Judah, but then Jesus brought it back. Jesus sat on the throne of David, the virgin conceived, and there's your single fulfillment. Well, that's a good defensive point. I still don't believe that that view is correct, though. Here's another point in favor of the single fulfillment view. Micah's parallel prophecy is messianic, and Micah was contemporaneous with Isaiah. He did start prophesying after Isaiah a little bit. We read in Micah 5, verses 2 through 3, Bethlehem Ephrathah, you are small among the clans of Judah. One will come from you to be ruler over Israel for me. His origin is from antiquity, from eternity. Therefore, he will abandon them until the time when she who is in labor has given birth. Then the rest of his brothers will return to the people of Israel. Of course, Micah is referring to the Virgin Mary there. God will abandon the people until the Messiah comes, until Mary is in labor, giving birth to the Messiah. And that's a very similar idea of a virgin birth. And so the argument goes, God is just giving prophecies to people that are going to be fulfilled in the future. And Isaiah's chapter 7, verse 14 prophecy is one of those prophecies. Now, Isaiah 7, 14 says that the virgin will give birth to a son. And here's another argument in favor of the single fulfillment view, is that the candidates for the son during Ahaz's time are improbable. Well, before I go through a bunch of speculations about who that son is, the son of the virgin, and of course that means the virgin who was a virgin before she got married. Obviously, she's not a virgin after she got married. Who would this son be? Well, just to cut to the chase, I believe it was just some unknown woman, or at least unknown to us, probably unknown to Ahaz too, some woman in the royal household, and she's going to get married, get pregnant, and have a child named Emmanuel. Ahaz hears about it, and now he knows the prophecy is fulfilled, so the son doesn't have to be named. But the single fulfillment view say that that is a weakness, that the double fulfillment view people can't name the son. Some examples of suggestions as to who this son is, Hezekiah. Well, Hezekiah was the son of Ahaz, so Ahaz would have had to marry somebody and had a son, Hezekiah. Well, that can't be true because Hezekiah was already 13 years old at this time, between 9 and 13 years old. Another possible objection is why would Ahaz's wife, Hezekiah's mother, why would she be called a virgin or an unmarried maiden? Well, remember, Alma can be translated as young woman too, whether she's married or not. So that's not really an objection to the son being Hezekiah, but the main objection is if Ahaz had a son and he gives him not only the name of Hezekiah, but the name of Emmanuel, well, then Ahaz would be fulfilling the prophecy himself. And that doesn't make any sense at all. So that can't be who the son is. The son of Ahaz has got to be son of some unnamed virgin who, after prophecy, got married, had a son, and named that son Emmanuel, not knowing that the prophecy of Isaiah had predicted that a son named Emmanuel would be born. There have been some other speculations about who this son might be. Some say it's Mahershalal Hashbaz, who will show up in a later chapter. We're not going to worry about all that. Well, let's go now to the double fulfillment view and give arguments for that. First of all, the view says that the virgin is an unmarried young woman. She's a virgin. She's within the royal house. She would get married and then become not a virgin, and then she would conceive. So she was a virgin at the time of the prophecy, but not at the time of conception. So when Isaiah was prophesying to Ahaz, he says, a virgin shall conceive. He means a virgin as of right now. She's in ignorance of the prophecy because Isaiah privately prophesied to Ahaz. So her naming of the son as Emmanuel is not influenced by the prophecy. Now there's a further time indicator. By the time this young son is old enough to eat curds and honey, and when he knows enough to reject the right and the wrong, which is about the same time. In other words, he's got to be old enough to be able to make moral distinctions before he gets to that age, Pekah, and reason will be laid waste. They're going to be wiped out. That would be very shortly after this prophecy was given, very shortly after the woman had the baby. The prophecy was given to Ahab by Isaiah in about 732. Here's some dates from Wikipedia. Tiglath-Pileser III conquered Pekah in about 733, which is a little bit too early. But like I say, once we get within 2 years of these ancient dates, that's close enough. 732, Tiglath-Pileser conquered and killed Rezin of Syria. So very shortly after this prophecy was given, Pekah and Rezin are wiped out, just like Isaiah prophesied. Now, the next problem is, how did Matthew take this prophecy and apply it to the Virgin Mary? Well, as you know, as I'm sure you know by now, New Testament writers were very loose when they took Old Testament prophecies. They would take an Old Testament statement or prophecy and apply it to some New Testament occurrence and just take one aspect of the Old Testament prophecy. So we read in Matthew 1:23, "See, the virgin will become pregnant and give birth to a son, and they will name him Emmanuel," which is translated, "God is with us." Matthew just took the Old Testament doings of Ahaz and Isaiah, and he applied it to what he saw in front of him. But he changes it a little bit. The virgin is now a virgin at the time of conception. Now, the Greek word there, parthenos, is virgin, and that can mean young maiden, too. We're not going to get into all that. And you say, well, that matters here because it needs to mean virgin. We need to go into all the philological and linguistic arguments to make parthenos mean virgin. Well, I don't have to do that because I read in the next verse, Matthew 1:24, second part of the verse, and Matthew 1:25, first part of the verse, "He," that's Joseph, "married Mary, but did not know her intimately until she gave birth to a son." So Matthew says she's a virgin. I don't care how you translate the word. Matthew says she's a virgin. And he takes the Old Testament Isaiah prophecy and he applies it to the Virgin Mary, which is the way New Testament writers often did. Now, Matthew quotes Isaiah completely. He says, "See, the virgin will become pregnant and give birth to a son, and they will name him Emmanuel," which is translated, "God with us." And then Matthew saying, isn't that nice? The name Emmanuel applies perfectly to Jesus because God is with us. So let me summarize the argument over the meaning of virgin here. In both Hebrew and Greek, the word translated virgin can have two meanings. It can mean either young woman or it can mean virgin. In Isaiah's case, virginity had nothing to do with the situation because the woman obviously was not a virgin when she gave birth to the child. She was a virgin or a young woman before she was married, and that's when Isaiah was speaking. So however you translate it, it's irrelevant in Isaiah's time because the woman was obviously not a virgin when she gave birth to the child. But now in Matthew's case, it does matter that Mary be a virgin. Well, the word parthenos can be translated that way, maybe not always, but sometimes. And here it should be because in the very next verse, Matthew 1:24, Matthew says that Mary was a virgin when she gave birth to a son, until she gave birth to a son. We go now to Isaiah 17:19. Isaiah continues, "The Lord will bring on you and on your people and on the house of your father a time unlike any since Ephraim broke away from Judah. He will bring the king of Assyria." Well, now, Isaiah's already given Ahaz some good news that Pekah and Rezin will be beaten by Assyria. But now the bad news. Now, remember, the prophecy is given not just to Ahaz, but also to Ahaz's house. We've already mentioned that. In verse 13, Isaiah says, "Hear now, you house of David," not just Ahaz. Ahaz is the ancestor of some other Davidic kings. And now in verse 17, Isaiah says, "The Lord will bring on you, Ahaz, and on your people, and on the house of your father," the house of your father, the house of your ancestor David, some bad, bad times from Assyria. And of course, the most famous of this was in Hezekiah's time. Hezekiah reigned between 716 and 687 B.C. He had to deal with Assyria. In 701, Sennacherib came, famous story we talked about when we went over 2 Kings. I'm not going to read that to save time. Now, this bad time that's coming from Assyria is said by Isaiah to be a time unlike any since Ephraim broke away from Judah. Now, that's referring to the division of the United Kingdom of Israel in 931 when Solomon's sons Rehoboam offended the northerners and they split up in 931. Now, if you track between 931, the times of Rehoboam, through the southern kings of Judah, all the way down to Ahaz, where we are now, we're going to see some bad, bad times. I'm going to give you those bad times. And Isaiah is saying, well, they were bad, but it's going to be worse. In Rehoboam's time, between 931 and 913, there was civil war during the times of Rehoboam. We read in 2 Chronicles 14:9, "Then Zerah the Cushite came against them with an army of 1,000,000 men and 300 chariots. In Asa's time, 911 to 870, again, this is a southern king, Judah, 2 Chronicles 16:1, "In the 36th year of Asa, Israel's king Baasha went to war against Judah." And then in the next king's reign, Jehoshaphat, who reigned from 870 to 848, we read in 2 Chronicles 21, "After this, the Moabites and Ammonites, together with some of the Meunites, came to fight against Jehoshaphat." Then in the next king, Jehoram, 848 to 841, we read in 2 Chronicles 21:16, "The Lord put it into the mind of the Philistines and the Arabs who lived near the Cushites to attack Jehoram." Unrelenting warfare. And then, of course, Ahaz himself had suffered some bad stuff from Pekah and Rezin already. I'm assuming that these disasters were before Isaiah's prophecy, as Barnes does. In 2 Chronicles 28:6, we read, Pekah, son of Remaliah, killed 120,000 in Judah in one day, all brave men, because they had abandoned the Lord God of their ancestors. Now, I've already mentioned that, 120,000 dead. And two verses later, in 2 Chronicles 28:8, then the Israelites took 200,000 captives from their brothers. 200,000 captives. Bad stuff. But Isaiah says, bad as that was, from the time that Ephraim, northern Israel, broke away from Judah, the southern kingdom, bad as that was, not going to be anything like what happens when God's going to bring the king of Assyria on you, Ahaz, that same king that you're trying to ally yourself with. So let's read some scriptures that show how Isaiah's prophecy was fulfilled. 2 Chronicles 28:20. Then Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came against Ahaz. He oppressed him and did not give him support. That's the same Tiglath-Pileser III of Assyria that Ahaz wanted to ally himself with to get Pekah and Rezin off his back. Tiglath-Pileser III was one of the most feared and cruel tyrants of the ancient Near East. It's terrible to be oppressed by that guy. But that's what happened to Ahaz, 2 Chronicles 28:20. Now going on with Ahaz's descendants, the house of Ahaz, who are also included in Isaiah's prophecy here, we look at Jehoahaz, who reigned very shortly in 608, Pharaoh Necho, or 609, well, 608 is the year after Josiah died. Pharaoh Necho imprisoned Jehoahaz at Riblah in the land of Hamath in northern Israel to keep him from reigning in Jerusalem, and he imposed on the land a fine of 7,500 pounds of silver and 75 pounds of gold. So it's not only Assyria that's going to be coming after the southern kingdom of Judah, it's also going to be Egypt. I probably should have mentioned back here in 2 Chronicles 20 and 21, I read that Tiglath-Pileser came against Ahaz, oppressing him and did not give him support. The next verse says, although Ahaz plundered the Lord's temple and the palace of the king and of the rulers and gave the plunder to the king of Assyria, it did not help him. He should have listened to Isaiah and to Yahweh and not allied himself with Tiglath-Pileser III. Cost him a bunch of money. Cost the land of Judah, his descendants, oppression from the Assyrians. Now in verse 18, Isaiah says, in that day the Lord will whistle for flies from the distant streams of Egypt and for bees from the land of Assyria. So I've already mentioned Egypt and Assyria are going to come on Israel. Egypt, Pharaoh Necho killed Josiah, 609, then took Jehoahaz as a captive to Egypt. And then, of course, the Babylonians were the big dogs right after that. So both of those two nations are going to oppress Judah. Flies from Egypt, bees from Assyria. The metaphor is easy to see because Egypt abounded with flies. That's probably what it means. Some people say it's symbolic. It refers to the multitude of their armies and the swiftness of their march, like house flies. Bzzzt. I don't think so. I think they had a lot of flies down there. I can imagine. And of course, this was fulfilled when Necho, as I mentioned, slew Josiah in 609 BC at Megiddo, famous event in Israel's history. Now, some people have suggested these flies from Egypt could refer to the Edomites or the Philistines, which bordered on Egypt. In other words, the flies would be coming from the direction of Egypt. I don't think so. The Ethiopians, for example, on the south of Egypt, perhaps they served with Nebuchadnezzar when they came up. A lot of speculation on that. We don't care. We'll just say Egypt came and wiped out Israel, and then the bees from Assyria came. One of my commentators said that the bees were as numerous in Assyria as the fly was in marshy Egypt. That's why there's so many flies in Egypt. There's so many marshes. John Gill says that the bees from Assyria include Sennacherib. He was the one who fought Hezekiah in 701 BC. Esarhaddon, he's the guy that finished the depopulation of northern Israel right before 669. And Nebuchadnezzar, that's a Babylonian, but he came from the same area of Assyria in Mesopotamia. So Assyria might refer to geography here, not just the kingdom. But the point is, there's a lot of trouble coming from the east, from the land of Assyria. Some people say the bees have special reference to the characteristics of the Assyrian armies, the number of the armies, their military order, their hurtful and mischievous nature. In other words, they'll sting you. In verse 19, the flies and the bees will all come and settle in the steep ravines and in the crevices in the rocks, on all the thorn bushes and at all the water holes. That's a great picture there. The flies and the bees coming in. That's referring to the invaders of southern Israel. As John Gill says, They should be in all cities, towns, and villages, whether fortified or not, and in all houses of high and low, rich and poor, in cottages and in palaces, there would be no place free from them, nor no escaping out of their hands. We move now to Isaiah 7, verses 20 through 22. In that day, Isaiah continues, the Lord will use a razor hired from beyond the river, the king of Assyria, to shave your head and the hair of your legs, and to take off your beards also. In that day a man will keep alive a young cow and two goats, and because of the abundance of the milk they give, he will have curds to eat. All who remain in the land will eat curds and honey. Now, this is a prediction of disaster, but it sounds like at the end that good things are going to happen. You're going to have a cow, you're going to have two goats, you're going to eat curds and honey. Well, we'll look at that and see that this is not a blessing here. In that day the Lord will use a razor. What day? Well, this will be the time of the Egyptian and Assyrian and Babylonian invasions that are coming on Israel. Sennacherib, Esarhaddon. Sennacherib in the time of Hezekiah, Esarhaddon in within Isaiah's 65-year period, somewhere around 667 or so, Pharaoh Necho in 609, 608, Nebuchadnezzar in 586. They're all coming from beyond the river. That's the river Euphrates, and that's where invasions came to Israel. Across the river, that Euphrates River was in Syria, and you would come from north to south over the river and invade Israel from the north. And God will use a razor. This is a metaphor here. A razor is noted for its sharpness and for its thorough work and its utter ruin and destruction when it's wielded on a beard. This razor, these Assyrians and Babylonians that are coming, is said to be hired. Well, one option as to what that means is that Ahaz had given a present to Tiglath-Pileser III of Assyria, and it didn't do him any good. He hired them, but unfortunately, he hired them to go after Syria and Ephraim, Syria and northern Israel, which he did, but then the razor was turned on Ahaz and Israel. 2 Kings 16, 7 through 9. So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. March up and save me from the power of the king of Aram and of the king of Israel, who are rising up against me. Ahaz also took the silver and gold found in the Lord's temple and in the treasuries of the king's palace and sent them to the king of Assyria as a gift. So the king of Assyria listened to him and marched up to Damascus and captured it. He deported its people to Kir, but put Rezin to death. Well, that's good. Ahaz hired Assyria to get his short-term problem taken away, but unfortunately, he still got a long-term problem coming from beyond the river, from Assyria and the Babylonians, the successors to Assyria. And again, this is going to happen after Ahaz has died, but this is referring to the house of Ahaz. So this razor is going to come to shave your head and the hair of your legs. Shaving a head was a way to show much disgrace on POWs that were caught. It was a sign of reproach and servitude. Remember when David sent some emissaries up to Ammon, Hanun, the king of Ammon, in 2 Samuel 10:4, took David's emissaries, shaved off half their beards. That was to humiliate them. Now, shaving the hair of legs. Now, why would that be a sign of disgrace? Well, I think the answer to that is given to us by John Gill, who says that this refers to the hair of one's private parts. So we have a great metaphor here. Judah will be completely and thoroughly humiliated. Now, what's this reference to cows and goats? Verse 21 says that a man will keep alive a young cow and two goats. This refers to the fact that Sennacherib, Esarhaddon, Pharaoh Necho, and Nebuchadnezzar, they invaded the land and desolated the land. So there was no normal pasturage and farming. So people would have to go to subsistence. They would just keep an individual cow and two goats instead of having a flock of goats or a herd of cows. In verse 22, because of the abundance of the milk they give, the reason there's an abundance of milk is because there's nobody to buy the milk. There's no market. It's been wiped out. As John Gill says, the cow and the two sheep, having large pastures and few cattle to feed upon them, those few would give such abundance of milk that the owner of them would make butter of it and live upon it, having no occasion to eat milk, and there being few or none to sell it to. I think he meant to drink milk. In other words, the pastures are going to be depopulated. No more sheep, no more goats. So those sheep and goats will eat the grass. They'll produce curds. They'll produce, well, they won't produce honey. Honey will have to be gathered. And they'll have an abundance of milk because the pastures are empty. and there's plenty of grass for the remaining cows and goats to chew on, because most of the cows and goats have been wiped out. All who remain in the land will eat curds and honey. They won't be eating meat because the cows and the goats have been wiped out. We go now to Isaiah 7, verse 23 through 25, and we will finish this chapter. In that day, in every place where there were 1,000 vines worth 1,000 silver shekels, there will be only briars and thorns. Men will go there with bow and arrow, for the land will be covered with briars and thorns. As for all the hills once cultivated by the hoe, you will no longer go there for fear of the briars and thorns. They will become places where cattle are turned loose and where sheep run. In other words, this is more of a picture of the destroyed land, no more agriculture, briars and thorns everywhere. Before the invasions from across the Euphrates River by the Assyrians and Babylonians, there were 1,000 vines worth 1,000 silver shekels, that's each. And of course, 1,000 is just not meant to be taken literally, it's a word meaning a lot. There were lots and lots and lots of vines, and they were worth, each of them, lots and lots and lots of money. How is a vine worth 1,000 shekels? Well, all the grapes on the vine could be sold for that much. I guess it could mean the vine itself could be worth 1,000 shekels, I don't know. But in place of this, briars and thorns, that phrase briars and thorns is mentioned 3 times that I see in these 3 verses, perfect symbol of a destroyed land. Men will go there with bow and arrow. It's necessary to have a bow and arrow to shoot the wild animals running around in the briars and thorns. As for the hills once cultivated by the hoe, you don't go there. Briars and thorns. The cattle are turned loose and the sheep run. No fencing anywhere. Cattle are on their own trying to feed themselves amongst the briars and the thorns, as well as the sheep. And on that unhappy note, Isaiah is finished letting Ahaz hold it because of his unbelief in God. We're now ready to go to chapter 8, which I will entitle The Coming Assyrian Invasion. I hope you stay tuned for that chapter, and I hope you enjoyed this one.